from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll learn about Milwaukee County Transit System's apprenticeship program for aspiring bus operators and mechanics. Then, in Capital Notes, we'll explore how Wisconsin's U.S. senators are reacting to President Trump's budget bill.
But the question is, what's the point where Ron Johnson might be happy enough with any changes that he can support it? Conversely, if they make changes to make Ron Johnson happy, will it upset House Republicans, then cause a problem over there? So it's a delicate dance right now.
And we'll hear from one of the voice actors who helped bring to life the Ojibwe language version of Star Wars: A New Hope.
I hope this film inspires many people to either begin or continue studying the Ojibwe language.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Later in the show, we'll learn about a new Milwaukee County Transit apprenticeship program that's training bus drivers and mechanics to fill gaps in an aging workforce. But we'll start today's show with Capital Notes.
This is Capital Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Ayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross. He's editor of WizPolitics.com. Hi, J.R., thanks for joining me.
Oh, anytime.
All right, so let's talk about the tax and spending bill heading through Congress. First of all, what parts of the bill do you think are most significant, potentially, for Wisconsinites?
Oh, good question. It's interesting because the mix of the cuts that Republicans are trying to pitch as a way to eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse, to get able-bodied adults off of the program and into the workforce, and a crack on those who are not here legally that are receiving benefits, whereas Democrats are pitching it as a cut to Medicaid. That's kind of the big messaging fight. The other thing I'm kind of watching is, can Ron Johnson get any changes made to this bill? Johnson has been on a remarkable run lately as in the national spotlight because he said he's not voting for the reconciliation bill without changes. He says he wants pre-pandemic spending. Now, when I talk to people, they don't think you're going to get that far. But the question is, what's the point where Ron Johnson might be happy enough with any changes that he can support it? Conversely, if they make changes to make Ron Johnson happy, will it upset House Republicans, then cause a problem over there? So it's a delicate dance right now.
Yeah, the bill has passed the House and it's going before the U.S. Senate. You just mentioned Senator Ron Johnson. What are Wisconsin's two U.S. senators' positions on this bill?
Well, they're both no's right now, but for very different reasons. Tammy Baldwin, the Democrat from Madison, is saying this cuts too deeply. It benefits the wealthy too much. She wants it rebalanced. She has said she's happy that Ron's a no right now, even though they're not on the same page. Why? For Johnson, it is all about spending, and he's been taking the stand of, I'm not going to vote for this thing, but I can stop this. There are enough people in the Senate who are the same page as I am that we've got to change this entire thing when it comes to the deficit and make it better. If you read national media, the House Speaker is saying, hey, if you guys in the Senate make too many changes, I've got problems. So there's this interesting dance going on. They're trying to figure out where that sweet spot is. It's kind of intuitive. Look at what Johnson did back in 2017. He had problems with the first Trump tax package because of how it treated pass-throughs, the smaller businesses. He wanted to be treated basically equal to corporations. He wanted a tax rate at a certain amount. The bill had another one. They kind of met in the middle. So for Johnson, is he going to have another one where a compromise can get him on board? Or is he going to dig in and say, no, unless you give me everything I want? It's a fascinating look at the kind of power he has or the opportunity to shape this bill that impacts the entire country.
And can you give us a little explainer on what the procedure is for this bill to become law? Like, what's the timeline? What are we looking at here?
Well, so first, it's a reconciliation bill, which means you don't need to cross a threshold in the Senate to beat the filibuster. It just simple majority is fine. They want to get this done by July 4th and on the president's desk. That is a very aggressive timeline. The fiscal year ends September 30th. Some nationally think that might be more of a realistic expectation when it'll get done. But they have to agree the same bill in the same form in the two houses for it to go to the president. that's the question right now. Can they reach an agreement on what this thing should look like?
What happens if they don't by September 30th?
Well, then, you know, there's all kinds. I don't mean to chuckle, but there's like a cascading number of financial issues. Spending bills for the fiscal year. Two, the debt ceiling. It goes on and on and on about what's going to happen. And so they've got a number of things to unravel in D.C. to keep the government humming along. And if they don't, then there's all kinds of problems. I mean, just like the debt ceiling, for example, that is in the reconciliation bill. There are certain Republicans who want to take it out. If you don't raise the debt ceiling, we could, in theory, default on our obligations. That would cause all kinds of economic turmoil. It's amazing in Washington, D.C., oftentimes there are big problems like that that miraculously work themselves out when deadlines kind of are hit. So we'll see when the real deadlines start to creep up how willing they are to strike a deal and get something done.
And if the bill passes as it's currently written, there would be work requirements for Medicaid. It's the safety net program that provides health insurance plans for low and moderate income people or those with disabilities. Under the bill, beginning at the end of 2026, childless adults without disabilities would be required to work 80 hours per month to qualify for benefits. What could be the impacts in Wisconsin?
Well, I don't have good numbers what's happening, who that would impact in Wisconsin, but the arguments are, on the one hand, from Republicans of this is needed to then get people in the workforce because we do have a labor shortage in Wisconsin, like a lot of the country. There are lots of jobs to fill, and Republicans will argue that if you are an able-bodied adult who can work, you should work. Democrats will tell you that this requirement will push people off of Medicaid. They're fearful that those work requirements will be difficult to meet or that there'll be confirmation checks that will then be problematic or slow the process down and people get pushed off the program. So they're worried this is going to be a way that people are going to lose their health care who need it badly.
You're tuned into Capital Notes. I'm WEWM's Mayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WizPolitics.com. Okay, also, if this reconciliation bill passes, it would have some other major impacts on SNAP benefits. That's actually the program that's called Food Share in Wisconsin. It's a program that provides food assistance to low-income people, and Republicans are trying to cut $230 billion nationally from SNAP. If that happens, there's been some reporting from the Journal Sentinel that Wisconsin would have to come up with anywhere from between $175 million to about $300 million a year to cover the roughly 700,000 Wisconsinites who rely on that program. Do you know anything about this?
Oh, well, I mean, this is what the House has approved. What's the Senate going to do? That's going to be a big question. And then two, if the Senate does sign off on what the House did, how is the state going to respond? Remember, we're in the middle of a state budget process right now, too. The fiscal year for us ends September, June 30th. Lawmakers, governor have been meeting to try to work out a compromise, but they need to get something done. Well, they want to get something done by June 30th. It's a symbolic thing to have it done with the fiscal year being over, but they have a lot of uncertainty of like, okay, what's going to happen with Medicaid or SNAP? Like, what happens to those programs? How does that affect what we're trying to do? It complicates the process of passing a budget, a state budget for Wisconsin. And, you know, it's an open question about whether Republican lawmakers would be willing to find more state money to keep that level of funding going for the program.
And how would they do that? Like, if these major cuts go through to the federal budget, how would state legislators and, for that matter, the governor make up for it?
That's a great question because we have a big budget surplus. That is one-time money. And I stress that because if you have ongoing expenses and you use one-time money for ongoing expenses, it tends to cause a hole for you in future budgets you have to deal with. So would they be willing to put a bunch of money in that program to make a long-term commitment if it's not that money isn't here to be there next budget? So they're working through right now just big things like trying to work on taxes and education and childcare, not to diminish the importance of SNAP, but that's their focus is right now, their attention, and they're waiting for more details from what's coming out of D.C. to figure out how these other things will impact the budget they're trying to do.
All right, switching gears a little bit, Wisconsin Republicans had their state political convention a few weeks ago, and Democrats are having theirs in mid-June. Democrats are also pondering a new state chair as longtime chair Ben Wickler is stepping down. What should we know about the two parties' current priorities?
Well, Republicans had a convention, and the big question hanging over that one was, would Brian Schimming, the state party chair, face any kind of a challenge or blowback? Republicans were riding high in November of last year. They won Wisconsin presidential race. They felt great. They were celebrating all that. Then the liberal candidate, Susan Crawford, wins the Supreme Court race in April. And all of a sudden, the party is like just aghast. Like, what are we doing? There's a real kind of pall over that party right now about its organization and its performance in off-year elections. It is obvious now Republicans do very well when Trump is on the ballot. It has become the party of Donald Trump. When Trump is not on the ballot, however, they are struggling to figure out how do we win when he's not there. Two, they've got some financial challenges. They are not pulling in nearly as much as Democrats. So how do they fix those? John Leiber, state treasurer, Schimming has directed Leiber to do a postmortem of the April election and make recommendations on how to improve things. Leiber hopes to have that report done by kind of early July, he told me. So we'll look for that. For Democrats, the question is, what's the best path forward post-Wickler? Wickler has been the best fundraiser we've ever seen in Wisconsin, state party chair. There's no question. Nobody even like comes close to matching him. Now, granted, he had the advantage over some past chairs of these campaign finance laws in Wisconsin, which allow unlimited donations to the state parties. That's got to be mentioned. But he's been phenomenal in that regard. And has a pretty good winning record, other than losing the presidential race last fall, right? There are three people who have filed to run to replace him. William Garcia is chair of the 3rd Congressional District Democratic Party. Devin Remicker is currently, or was, sorry, was previously the political and executive director for the party under Wickler. And Joseph Pecky is a Democratic operative out of Milwaukee. The two folks are watching the most are Remicker and Zepecki. Remicker was endorsed by Wickler. We'll see how that plays. For the most part, people see it as a good thing. Sometimes party activists don't like being kind of like pressured to support somebody. So maybe some blowback to it, but definitely a sign that Wickler thinks Remicker is the best chance. And Remicker is saying, I want to build upon what Wickler did and carry us going forward. So Pecky is looking at more of, hey, we as Democrats got to figure out a better message. Look what happened in November, the problems we have in polls with various constituencies. We can do things differently. So it's going to be a kind of a question of a change or stay the course election for Democrats when they meet in mid-June.
And for that matter, you had mentioned Schimming. He didn't ultimately get any blowback, and he's still the party chair for the GOP.
Yeah. I mean, Republicans elect their state party chair every 2 years in the December after an election, and they do it through their executive committee, which is made up of top leaders from congressional district parties and other folks. He wasn't going anywhere. There's this split with Republicans where they have these different factions. Like, they call them patriot groups. You've got Trump folks. You've got traditional Republicans who were in the party before Donald Trump came on the scene. They're just not on the same page right now, and they're just kind of unhappy because they've been losing. And so Schimming's fairly secure, but there's definitely a vibe with that party of they want him to pick up the fundraising. They want him to start, Republicans start winning more races. And that's going to be the key for his success going forward.
And speaking of a state body where there are races, but there's not one at the moment, but there's a key case before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It's expected to make a decision soon on a major abortion case. When are you expecting a decision on that, and what are you watching for?
Good question. Usually we have decisions out before the end of the term, which is July 31st, so it could be any day now. The question in that case is, a Dane County judge ruled this 1849 law that had been interpreted as banning abortion wasn't about abortion. The only exception was for the life of the mother. A Dane County judge ruled actually that law applies to infanticide, so there wasn't about abortion at all. Will the court go along with that argument? Josh Call, the attorney general, he argued actually that did a different tact, that law can't be enforced because it is basically dated. There have been a number of amendments or other abortion laws passed since 1849. He argues those take precedent and that one can't be enforced. So where will the court end up on that? And then there's another case out there that court hasn't heard yet about whether there's a constitutional right to abortion in the Wisconsin Constitution. That would be an interesting case to see how the court comes down, because that might then guarantee abortion rights in Wisconsin, much like Roe v. Wade did in the country before that was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2022.
All right. Thanks so much. As always, thanks for the context, JR, and thanks for joining me on Capital Notes.
Have a great day.
You can hear Capital Notes every other Monday on Lake Effect. And did you know you can also listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Coming up, we'll talk to one of the voice actors in the Ojibwe version of Star Wars: A New Hope. But first, we'll hear from an apprentice in Milwaukee County Transit's program to train bus drivers and mechanics. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Milwaukee County Transit System, or MCTS, recently launched an apprenticeship program for bus drivers and mechanics to fill gaps in an aging workforce. Competition for skilled labor can be fierce across industries, in part due to a shortage of trained talent. As a state, Wisconsin is stepping up its support for apprenticeship opportunities across a variety of industries, setting a record last year of more than 17,000 registered apprentices. But as Lake Effect Sam Woods finds, this story is about more than filling gaps on a ledger. It's about meeting an increase in demand for public transportation, investing in ourselves, and realizing dreams.
On a windy day outside MCTS headquarters on Milwaukee's north side, lawmakers, transit officials, media, and Milwaukee residents gather to celebrate new beginnings.
And on behalf of the state of Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development, we certify that the MCTS Coach Bus Mechanic and Coach Bus Operator programs meet the standards of Wisconsin apprenticeship in our today certified apprenticeship programs.
That's David Polk, director of the Wisconsin Bureau of Apprenticeship Standards. He's officially welcoming two MCTS apprenticeship programs training bus drivers and mechanics into the statewide family of apprenticeships. And this family is growing. In the last 3 years, Wisconsin has set a new record each year for the number of participants in its registered apprenticeship programs, last year totaling over 17,000 statewide. This includes more traditional trades like construction and plumbers, but also roles like teachers and arborists. It's a journey Polk himself is intimately familiar with.
Mr. Shorter alluded to, I started my career off as an apprentice, as a plumbing apprentice. And one of the things that I would like to say to all of our new apprentices here today is welcome to the family. All right.
While MCTS ridership increased by 13% last year, according to the agency's annual report, finding longtime bus drivers and mechanics has been difficult lately, according to Donna Brown Martin, Milwaukee County's Director of Transportation.
Over the period during the pandemic, it was a struggle to get workers, one, to get them up to speed and on the training, and two, just to get them to be here for these jobs. There was so much competition in the trades, in the industry, and sometimes, you know, providing service to the public as a bus operator or a mechanic was not the very first thing on people's minds.
And not only that, but MCTS's workforce is aging.
There are so many people who have been in this industry for 20, 35 years. They're retiring. And as they retire, getting someone in place who can pick up on those skills and do that work is extremely important to us.
So what is a regional transit office like MCTS to do when faced with the dilemma of an aging workforce whose jobs require years of training to fill while demand for bus transit is increasing? Well, they turn to fixers, like Sharika Thomas.
I love service and I love people. Anything that I can do to help people, I have been told that and I do see that within myself. Service is kind of, that's my passion. So however that looks, whatever kind of outlet that is something that I just enjoy doing it. So it comes very naturally to me.
Today, Thomas is enrolled in MCTS's new mechanic apprenticeship program and is the first woman a mechanic, as well as the first Black woman a mechanic at MCTS. An A mechanic refers to a mechanic of the highest expertise, as opposed to a B or C mechanic. The letter grade indicates the complexity of problems she's certified to address. Her enrollment in the apprenticeship program entails 18 months of paid training, starting at $30 per hour. Thomas was born and raised in Milwaukee, around 14th and Burleigh on the city's north side, and she remembers training in this line of work unofficially as a kid.
I would do brake jobs and stuff with my stepfather growing up. So that was like me getting my hands dirty. And I love that because it seemed quick. You do something, you get paid. That was kind of how I started like even being interested in doing anything hands-on.
But Thomas's route from assisting on brake jobs with her stepdad to an A mechanic with MCTS was anything but linear. After graduating from Bradley Tech High School, she joined the Air Force, which led to exploring multiple employment paths.
I did traffic management there. I did 4 years active duty. Such a great experience. Came home. I went to college for criminal justice. I was going to be a cop. That was my plan when I got out. I worked with security forces, is what they call the police department, and I fell in love with it. Well, I got home. I realized doing it in the military is quite different from doing it in the streets of Milwaukee. So I went to school, and I wasn't really sure. I was thinking maybe social work. But in between that time, like I said, I'm working. I was doing security at the time. And so I'm kind of like, I don't want to do this.
Whether Air Force, police, or social work, Thomas says she was seeking ways to serve. She wanted to give back after growing up around people who helped her, whether it was her stepdad teaching her brake mechanics or a bus driver getting her to school and work on time. But shortly after having her first child, the way she wanted to serve others shifted.
I felt a little, I won't say, my need for danger changed too. After I had my daughter, being a cop was really out of the question. So that was why that was no longer an option for me.
Luckily, there were plenty of ways to give back. And from there, Thomas started her MCTS journey, albeit not immediately on the track toward becoming a mechanic.
I started as a cleaner tanker back in 2017. And that's the person that cleans the bus, basically gets it ready to go on the road the next day. And that, you know, that had worked out really well. It was a pay increase from my previous job. And yeah, I enjoyed it. I really love the people I work with. And a lot of people were encouraging me, you should try for the C mechanic. And I'm like, I don't know. I just kind of went for it. And I'm like, all right. Took the test. It took me 3 times to pass it, but enjoyed like learning. I just fell in love with the process.
But she got her foot in the door and was in training to become a C mechanic. This involved mentorship from mechanics that had been in the business for decades. Just as Thomas's stepdad taught her some basics years ago, it's essential for new recruits to get guidance from experienced mentors. Donna Brown Martin, Director of Transportation, explains.
The importance of having the ability to just get in and know someone who will be able to talk you through and who's willing to mentor and coach you through the mechanics of this process, how to get into the trades, how to take the tests. And there's numerous tests, how to utilize the tools, how to take care of those tools, the importance of just being here amongst the teams and delivering on the service that needs to happen 24/7. It's just incredibly important.
Thomas would be the first to agree that this mentorship was invaluable in her journey to where she is today. But that didn't mean there weren't culture clashes with more experienced mechanics.
There were people who were not excited about a woman being on the floor. Old school, you know, a lot of mechanics, they've been there for a long time. And that made me doubt, did I make the right decision? But for me, and I felt like, how do I fix the situation? I'm not really big on like wanting to prove things to people, but it was just like, the best thing I can do here is prove to myself that I am worthy to be here and to do this job. And that kind of was my way of fixing it. And at the same time, I feel like giving people a different view of just who I was, because not many people knew me personally. They just knew me at work. So I just feel like I got to show a different side of myself just by still showing up, still being positive, still being true to who I am, which is really important.
As you heard, Thomas is a fixer, whether it's fixing buses or interpersonal situations. But that doesn't mean that doubt never creeps in.
Do I really want to do this, or am I going to just kind of run away and find something else? No, something was like, no, you need to be here. And I really, truly felt that. I would have regretted not sticking through. And that was another thing for me, following through on things. I've had business ideas and everything, and I'll start it. And if it gets a little challenging, I'm like, it's probably not meant to be. When I started the Sea Mechanic, I said, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm going to follow through with everything that I decide to do. So it was very important. That's another thing going into this. If I start this, I'm going to finish it.
Back to the windy day outside MCTS HQ, in front of a WUWM mic and TV cameras, surrounded by public officials and her friends and family, Thomas's journey was recognized along with one other mechanic and over a dozen new bus drivers.
Everyone good? All right, so without any further ado, we're gonna just introduce our apprentices as they come around, starting with our mechanics. Paul Olson leading it off. Sharika Thomas.
When I spoke with Thomas, I asked her how she frames her journey. Is it through the lens of working your way to personal prosperity, securing a steady job that pays over $30 an hour? Or is this just the latest stop in her attraction to service? Or did she just step up when she saw a communal need? Instead, she told me a story about speaking at her daughter's school.
They asked me to do career day for Black History Month. Highly honored, but my position as a mechanic, being the only Black mechanic, led me to be able to speak at that engagement. And the response that I got from young women, I realized that's why I'm doing this. That's why I'm here. I always look for that kind of thing. Like this, it's something here. I'm very spiritual. And so I always look like, okay, God, you got this going on for something. That's when I realized all the difficulties, the challenges, the reason I had to stick through it was just for that moment. There were so many young women that came up to me and said, oh my gosh, I've never met a woman mechanic. And particularly, like I said, being the only African-American woman mechanic, that's a barrier that I never anticipated knocking down, but I can honestly see that there was a few young ladies who wills were turning. I never thought that was a career option. So for them just say, oh, you know, you're a boss, or for them to give me that, it was like, wow. If one or two of those young ladies probably have another option of a career that they would have never thought about had they not had that encounter with me. Those are the things that I realize, the bigger picture, why I'm doing this job.
Headlines about apprenticeships and pipelines into the trades often garner headlines about the number of jobs created, the family-sustaining pay, or the maintenance needs met by increasing trained workforce. All great stuff, but sometimes the generational impact can get lost in the numbers. For Thomas, this is all true. Steady employment at $30 per hour will meet the needs of her immediate family and gives her an opportunity to serve her community today and keep buses running. But it's the impact on the next generation that tells her she's really doing something that matters.
Even now when they see me, hi, mechanic lady, that like when I pick my girls up, my girls are super embarrassed by it because the big kids are scary to them still. But that to me meant so much. And it's still shocking for people to when I say that. Like, you're the only woman, but the first African-American woman. That to me was like, that meant a lot.
That piece was produced by Lake Effect's Sam Woods. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk going, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll talk to the longtime owner of a Milwaukee sports card shop. But first, we'll learn about the Ojibwe language version of Star Wars: A New Hope. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Star Wars universe was first introduced in 1977 with the film A New Hope. Since then, there have been many more films, series, and books that have kept us in a galaxy far, far away. Recently, the Star Wars universe expanded to include multi-generational Anishinaabe speakers. The classic film Star Wars A New Hope has been dubbed in Ojibwe. The project is a part of wider efforts to revitalize the language, which is used by one of the largest Native American tribes in the U.S. Nigani Anamaki Anini is the language culture coordinator of the Red Cliff Nation in northern Wisconsin. He's also the voice actor for the character Red Leader in Star Wars. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share his experience bringing the Ojibwe version of the film to life.
Nigani, welcome to Lake Effect. It's a pleasure to meet you.
It's a pleasure meeting you, Audrey.
So first off, are you a Star Wars fan?
Absolutely, since I was a child. How about you?
Absolutely. As I will show you over Zoom, the listeners can't see, but I have a Millennium Falcon tattoo. So, yes, Star Wars fan ever since I was little. My uncles first introduced me to the series, and they, of course, grew up with the original trilogy. So what was your first Star Wars exposure that got you hooked?
Well, if you remember in the 90s, they re-edited the original Star Wars. And so I watched those in theaters when I was a kid. And yeah, I've been a huge fan ever since.
Excellent. So you are a voice actor in the new release of Star Wars A New Hope in Ojibwe. So can you share how you heard of this opportunity and what the audition process was like? Because auditions were held in Manitoba, right?
Yeah. So I was perusing Facebook after work, like so many of us do. And I saw on one of my friends' pages an ad to apply to audition. And so that's where I learned about it first. And yes, the actual recording was in Winnipeg.
Okay. And did you know you were auditioning for the character of Red Leader, or was this just an open call, be a part of Star Wars?
Great question. So after I applied, I was invited to audition and to choose from several main characters to audition for. So I chose a handful, and the process was I had to record on my own computer reading lines in Ojibwe per character. And I was using my best intonations akin to what I was seeing in the original Star Wars, and then listening to the elders in my head to try and pronounce the Ojibwe the best I could. And I sent those in, and not long after, maybe a week or so, I heard back from the Disney crew asking for me to audition for one of those particular characters. We did the audition over Zoom with a director and one of her assistants. And, you know, I said the first two lines for this particular character, and she said, hold on. She offered me some suggestions. I took her suggestions to heart. I read the lines again, just one or two sentences. And then she said, you know what? I've heard enough. I've seen enough. I really like what you're doing here. I'm going to give you a role in Star Wars.
But you weren't sure which. It was just like, we're going to include you. Just wait and see.
Yes, yes. Didn't know yet which character. And I'm so proud to be giving voice to Red Leader, acted on screen by the late Drew Henley.
Of course. I mean, it's a big part, especially in the pivotal Death Star battle at the end of the film. And I can't imagine how anxious you were just, okay, knowing I'm going to be involved, don't know who or what so far. With Disney, and you think of Marvel movies, you know, were there NDAs, you know, where you kept under secret oath until, you know, the official word was out?
Yes, absolutely. We had to sign an NDA. I didn't, in fact, know who many of the actors were going to be until the release, the official news release.
Okay, so yeah, let's go into a bit more about the actual process of being a voice actor for A New Hope in Ojibwe. You're tasked with Red Leader. So did you also have to translate your part only, or was it a wider effort to help translate the whole Star Wars film? Can you just share how this process kind of unfolded for you?
Absolutely. So thankfully, Pat Nangawants, a first language speaker up north and a gifted teacher, she led a team of translators before these auditions. So the film was, all of the script was translated ahead of time. And so when I was auditioning, I was given lines, and not just given lines on paper, but also a recording of an elder pronouncing the lines to give some enunciation guidelines there as well. And so I didn't have to do any of the translating. I'm so grateful for Pat Nangawants and her team.
Well, and I like that detail of having a recording of an elder as well, because, you know, you can share better insight than I in this, but how important is having that elder's voice and pronunciation and style? Because with keeping a language alive, I imagine that's crucial to keep the language as accurate as you can.
100%, Audrey. If one pronounces a word just slightly differently, it can offer a huge, entirely different meaning to a word.
So with your work in voicing Red Leader, can you share a bit of your methodology or technique? Was it either to mirror the original actor's cadence of the lines, or were you able to enjoy some freedom in interpreting it in your own way to best serve the Ojibwe language?
Great question. So how I've been taught, Ojibwe tends to have a flatness to it. There aren't as many accenting, if you will. And in English, of course, there is an accent and stresses in the words. And so I asked the production team, do you want me to offer a flat traditional Ojibwe pronunciation, or do you want me to emanate the English actors? And they invited me to shoot towards the English actors. And so what I did was I watched the original scene over and over and over and over again. I did some background research. I found that Mr. Henley had negotiated with George Lucas. And at first, Mr. Lucas wanted Red Leader to be anxious from the beginning on out. And Mr. Henley thought that this character is a professional. He has years of experience. He's going to be calm throughout. And so what they negotiated, what they agreed upon was, at first, Red Leader would be very calm and collected. And towards the end of that scene, when things are getting quite heated, he's going to grow a little more anxious. And so I brought that information with me into the sound studio. And the director also invited certain emotions, certain loudness, guiding me in the studio as well.
I love that. I also love that I learned a new Star Wars fact today with that background of the actor. Did you go into like Lucasfilm archives? Where did you find some of this research? Or did the director have some additional information for you all to really connect with this film on a deeper level like that?
I just dug in online.
That's a great resource.
Usually.
Yeah. Turn to all the Star Wars nerds online. They'll have an answer.
Wait. There's a lot out there.
Yeah. And with the Ojibwe language, as you mentioned, being a little more flat, the scene you're in is a battle scene. And I love this insight that you start calm, but obviously things heat up. Spoiler alert, Darth Vader eventually shoots you down. You crash into the Death Star. But what were some of the best challenges or learning experiences about being involved in this film?
Oh, it was a great experience working in the studio. It was my first Hollywood film studio setup, and so it was me in the sound booth, and then the booth next to me was the director, her production team, and an elder. And this elder was able to offer any pronunciation guidance on the fly in the studio, which is great. He was able to correct a couple of my words, and that was a really fun experience. And you know, joking with him back and forth in Ojibwe, that felt really good.
Having the experience of recording, voicing Red Leader, having the director, an elder there with you, it seems like such a great interactive experience. And this is obviously part of a much wider effort for all the voice actors involved in A New Hope. What significance do you place on the role of Ojibwe language in popular films like Star Wars?
You know, Pat Nangawants said it really well. She earlier this year was the keynote speaker at Anishinaabe Mwenteg, the world's largest conference on the revitalization of Anishinaabe language. And in her speech, she offered a vision of within 100 years, all of our communities are doing everyday things in our language. So that's an Ojibwe person being able to go to the store, go to the school, watch films. Anything that you can do in English, you can also do in Ojibwe. So a part of this vision is making sure that films are either dubbed or produced in the Ojibwe language. And so this is just one small tool to help in this larger revitalization effort.
And how does it feel for you personally to be a part of the Star Wars universe in your language?
It's an incredible honor. It's an incredible honor.
So if you're willing, I'd love to give listeners a little taste of your work in the film. Would you like to toss lines back and forth? I'll say the English and you can share the Ojibwe translation that you worked on.
Sure, let's do a few.
All right, so we are acting as Red Leader here. I'll start with the first line. Cut the chatter, Red 2.
Bunkatoon, Red 2.
Red Boys, this is Red Leader.
Red Migazoo, mean Red Leader.
And the classic, pivotal line of Red Leader. Almost there.
Aja Giga. Aja Giga.
And unfortunately, your first target miss just impacted the surface. Oh, this is so much fun. Thank you. So this is your first taste of acting, right? Of voice acting?
This is my first taste of voice acting. I've done a few small things in terms of acting. I'm also a film producer and director, but I want to expand more into voice acting and acting.
How did this experience of voice acting outside of the other projects you've worked on give you more insight into room to grow, not just for yourself, but for more production and projects for Ojibwe language-led films or translated films?
So many of my lines are actually yelled into the microphone. And I'm not much of a yeller. I'm not a very loud person. And so that took a lot of effort for me. And the director, she said, many of the indigenous actors she's worked with struggle with being extra loud. And so that's one area I want to work on.
Well, what a project to get you started on voice acting. Congratulations to you and the whole effort of this film. Nagani, thank you for joining me on Like Effect to share more about it.
Thank you so much. And I want to ask the audience, if you haven't seen this film yet, if you're a fan of Star Wars, if you're a fan of a good story, if you're interested in learning more Ojibwe, I strongly encourage you to go watch this film. I hope this film inspires many people to either begin or continue studying the Ojibwe language.
May the Force be with you.
And may the Force be with you.
Nigani Anamaki Anini is a voice actor for the Ojibwe-dubbed Star Wars, who gives voice to the character Red Leader. He's also the language culture coordinator for the Red Cliff Ojibwe Nation in northern Wisconsin. Anini spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last year. The sports card shop, Name That Card, has been in business in Milwaukee for more than 30 years. Rick DeMore started it so local collectors could have a place to sell, browse, or consign sports cards. Lake Effect's Excret Nunez visited the store and spoke to DeMore about his passion for sports and collecting cards.
You've been running Name That Card for 30 years. What inspired you or encouraged you to open up a sports card shop?
Actually, I've been collecting cards since the 50s. I'm very old, okay? And I was one of the lucky guys whose parents never threw them away. So I had them all my life. I've loved it all my life. There was a gap there after you go to, you know, you're in high school. That's not cool anymore, you know. But I would still buy one pack to see what they look like that year. And then high school, you finish. And then, you know, you go to college and went in the military. And then I got married, okay. And all these years, maybe a good span till about 75, okay, when I settled back down and saw them probably one day in the basement, said, whoa, this is, I love this stuff. I got to see what they look like now. Well, that was it. I bought one pack before I knew it, I bought a case. You know, before I knew it, every year I was buying cases and I was hooked. And there were card shows and there were card stores in those days, but very limited, very limited. So it was like a real neat reawakening for me, okay? I just went nuts with it. And when I did leave the corporate world, I had to figure out what I was gonna do, like I said, when I grew up. And I kinda wanted to have my own thing. So I looked around and then this jumped out. It was the early 90s, and stores were booming, okay? And I did a lot of homework. I was a real anal guy, so I took the telephone book and plotted every sports card shop in Milwaukee at the time, okay? There were 47 of them. Went to visit about 90% of them. I talked with all of them. I said, how'd you do this? And I'm so-and-so, I'm coming into the thing. Oh, good, you know? And it was a real tight group in those days. And the one question that I asked that they all answered almost the same. So you do make profit. Yeah, I use that to pay your bills and stuff. No, I buy the old stuff with that. And I thought to myself, wow, I've got the old stuff. Maybe this is good. And it worked out well for a lot of years. No, there's been a lot of ups and downs in 30 years. I was probably ready to quit 4 or 5 times, okay? But always something. I've always been very fortunate. Something has come up and kept me going. So the other thing that I did, I put a wall of honor up there, okay, to let the people know. Well, it was 1993 I started it, and it ran for about a good 10, 15 years. I had a Polaroid one shot, okay, and you could just take them, boom, get the picture right away. It was awesome, right? Well, anytime anyone got a good card, and a good card in a box of packs is a card that has either an autograph on it or a piece of the guy's jersey, the person's jersey, right? And those were scarce in those days, okay? So if you got one of those, whoa, it was really cool, I'd take your picture, put it up on the wall. So it was two birds with one stone. Number one, let's go to Mr. Rick's and we'll check out the wall here. My picture's up there. That's one thing. The other thing is, you know, you could get the good stuff here. So it was a godsend. It was just another, you know, I use that not too loosely because I'm very proud of it and happy for it and very grateful for it.
Do you have any cards that mean a lot to you? Maybe it's not like the most expensive or anything like that, but do you have any cards that mean a lot to you?
Yeah, over the years, you know, I've collected a ton of cards. My favorite, though, is one of my favorite ball players. I got to meet him when I was in 8th grade. His name is Eddie Matthews. He was the third baseman for the Milwaukee Braves. Well, I grew up, like the kids today are going with the Brewers and seeing the Brewers. I grew up with the Milwaukee Braves. Okay, they started here in 53. My best friend was the visiting clubhouse bat boy for the Braves. So he and I are sitting at the corner one day, and all of a sudden I hear beep, beep. I turn around, here's a red Chevy convertible, tops down, and it's Eddie Matthews. Whoa, are you kidding? I start to make out for the road, and I almost get hit by a car. I jump back. He pulls over, screeches this guy, pulls over and comes out, and he's just giving me holy blazes, okay? And I'm thinking, this is the greatest day of my life. Are you kidding me? I'm getting dissed by Eddie Matthews, okay? Over the years, I was able to meet him then through my friend, and I just did all my homework about him. I have his rookie card, and I keep it in a safe, okay? Wow. It's from 1952. That's the same year Mickey Mantle's rookie card came out, which just sold recently for $12.6 million. Eddie's isn't that expensive, okay? But it's an expensive card, and I just keep it off site.
How large of a collection would you say you have in numbers, and how far back in time does your collection go?
Those are really good questions. It's millions of cards, okay? And it goes back to the early 50s. However, the pandemic was my best and worst time, okay? It was my best year in 30 years, the main pandemic year, okay? Because people didn't have access to stuff and they were wanting to spend their money and buy cards. I pretty much sold 90% of my favorite cards that I was never going to sell just to stay alive. And then you got to take care of them, okay? Because any little ding, any crease, this expensive card just goes right down the sewer. It takes away a lot of the value. The ones that are really, really old, they're excused. They're grandfathered in. I mean, you get an old 1935 card of Babe Ruth, it's not going to be $20,000, but it'll still be a lot of money.
So my last question is, why should someone consider getting into collecting or trading cards?
You know, it's a personal thing. Like any other hobby or collectible type of thing. There's people that collect matches. There's people that collect coins. There's, you know, why would they get into those? You know, I can't tell you why, but I'd say some of the reasons why people do it are because they love the sports. Yeah, there's an investment aspect going on right now. I mean, there's nothing, this is like a lottery. When you buy a pack of cards, you can get a card that's, it's crazy. You can get a card that's worth $20, $50, $1,000. So it's like a lottery. It really is.
Rick DeMore is the owner of Name That Card, a sports card shop in Milwaukee. He spoke with Lake Effect's Excrit Nunez last year. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn if a Wisconsinite found love on Fox's reality dating show, Farmer Wants a Wife. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.